From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In his new memoir, Robert McNamara says the U.S. government was terribly wrong in how it handled the war in Vietnam. As Secretary of State under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, McNamara was one of the chief architects of the war. On today's Fresh Air, Robert McNamara reassesses the war in Vietnam. Also today, actor Peter Gallagher, the womanizing lawyer in Sex, Lies, and Videotape, now stars in Steven Soderbergh's new film, The Underneath. Gallagher also co-stars in the new romantic comedy, While You Were Sleeping. Also, the 94-95 TV season ended last week. TV critic David Bianculli tells us what shows topped the list. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A man held as a material witness in the Oklahoma City bombing case has been charged with conspiracy and firearms violations. James Nichols is not charged in the Oklahoma City bombing, but a federal prosecutor says Nichols conspired with his younger brother and with Oklahoma bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh to make bombs in Michigan. Rescue workers in Oklahoma City say the confirmed death toll is still at 87. The workers had wanted to finish working in the daycare center and the Social Security office today, but as NPR's John Burnett reports, the debris is just too dangerous.
The latest thing that we've heard is that firefighters inside the bombed-out federal building have spotted three bodies now believed to be those of children. They have had to use flexible cameras to look underneath some concrete blocks, and the bodies are still several feet underneath where they're working, so it'll take some more time to get to them. Yesterday, the assistant fire chief, John Hansen, who's been giving us most of the updates, said that he thought they would be into the areas where they're going to find most of the bodies, those being the daycare center and the Social Security office. They thought they'd be there by today, but the tremendous amount of pulverized rock and twisted metal has just pushed that back. So now they're saying it may well be tomorrow, much longer before they reach those areas and are able to bring out more bodies.
The Senate has passed a resolution condemning the blast. It praises the Clinton administration for its quick work and calls for the death penalty for those who are responsible. The United Nations says nearly 200,000 Rwandan refugees are trying to return to their homes after fleeing camps in southwest Rwanda. Officials say many of them are dying. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The UN now says at least 2,000 people were shot to death or trampled as a result of efforts by the Rwandan army to force the 120,000 inhabitants to leave one refugee camp. Officials say these refugees have now been joined by about 80,000 more and are heading back to their original homes, which they fled almost a year ago. UN spokesman Joe Sill says more deaths are expected.
We have reports that many people on the road have collapsed and died due to injuries or exhaustion or dehydration. I think I would agree that it's not going well. There's a huge number of people unexpectedly put on the road.
Sill says way stations have been set up to provide food and water. Meanwhile, the UN has been criticized for not having done more to protect the people in the camps from the Rwandan army. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
A private realtors group says mortgage interest rates have been falling lately. The National Association of Realtors says that's given a boost to the housing market. The group says sales of existing homes rose 5.8% in March. That's the first upward showing in 3 months. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 3.5 points to 4,300. This is NPR. The FBI says it appears the Unabomber has struck again. A mail bomb killed a timber industry lobbyist yesterday in Sacramento. It appears to be the work of the same person blamed for 15 other mail bomb incidents over the last 17 years. Two people were killed in those attacks and 23 people hurt. The FBI says the special federal Unabomber task force has taken over the case. Unabomber refers to the killer's desire to target people who work at universities. The bomber also seems to have a fascination with wood. Some bomb parts are carved out of wood. One victim was named Wood. Twigs have been included in one bomb. An Islamic activist hospitalized in Jerusalem after he was interrogated by Israeli security forces has died. Human rights groups say the interrogators are responsible. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Police said that 30-year-old Abdel Samad Harizat from the West Bank city of Hebron was detained last week. A Jerusalem hospital spokesman said Harizat arrived at the hospital several days ago with severe injuries and brain damage. An Israeli human rights group said today it believes the man's injuries were inflicted by Israeli interrogators. The Justice Ministry said it is investigating. A senior Israeli security source said Harizat was one of the leaders of the Hamas military wing in the area and was responsible for several attacks on Israelis. In the past few years, several Palestinians have died while under Israeli interrogation. Last year, interrogators were granted greater leeway in questioning Islamic militants after a series of attacks on Israelis. Human rights groups say this leeway amounts to permission to torture suspects, a claim Israeli officials deny. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Turkey says it's pulled back most of its troops from Iraq, where soldiers have been fighting Kurdish insurgents. A Turkish military spokesman says 20,000 troops have returned to bases within Turkey. They'd been assigned to wipe out Kurdish camps used for hit-and-run attacks on Turkey. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After years of refusing to speak about the Vietnam War, Robert McNamara has written a memoir about leading it. McNamara was Secretary of Defense under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson and was one of the principal architects of the war. Now, he says, he and his colleagues who ran the war were, quote, wrong, terribly wrong. He says he owes it to future generations to explain why. McNamara has been praised and condemned for his new memoir, which has reopened the debate on the war in Vietnam. The book, In Retrospect, will be number one on the New York Times bestseller list this Sunday. I asked Robert McNamara if he thinks of his book as an apology to the American public.
Some people have used redemption, apology. Forget redemption and apology and say that I think those of us, assuming for the minute I'm correct, as I say in the preface, I believe it was an error, a tragic error. Assume for the minute that my judgment is correct. Then I think we owe an explanation to future generations of what happened and how to avoid that in the future. That's the purpose of the book.
To explain.
To explain, and more than explain, to draw lessons and suggest how to prevent similar tragedies in the future.
Do you think an apology is appropriate?
Well, if you want me to apologize, of course. But that's not the issue. The issue isn't apology. You don't I'll call it correct a wrong by apologizing. You can correct a wrong only if you understand how it occurred and you take steps to ensure it won't happen again.
In your book, you raise what you describe as a profound, enduring, and universal ethical and moral dilemma. How, in times of war and crisis, can senior government officials be completely frank to their own people without giving aid and comfort to the enemy?
I do. You're correct.
So looking back, what do you think should have been done?
That's an easy answer. You say what should have been done. It's not going to be relate entirely to this moral dilemma, but I think serious errors were made in failing to, I'll call it, obtain the approval of the American people and their representatives in Congress to involving this nation in a land war in Asia. Now, you could say, or your audience will say, well, that's the wrong answer. The Johnson administration had the full written approval of the Congress to introduce whatever military forces it believed necessary into Asia. And that's correct on the surface. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution passed in 1964 gave the president full authority to introduce whatever force he needed in Asia. But the Congress didn't intend at that time, and the president made clear he didn't intend at that time to use the resolution to send the forces we eventually sent. So we were wrong. We did not obtain the authority of the people and their representatives to do what we did, and that was wrong.
But the question that you raised in what I just quoted is, how do you deal with information that doesn't look good for our side when you're afraid it's going to give comfort to the enemy?
That's a very important point, and it's less important, by the way, than the one I've just made, however.
But you mean you want to pass on lessons from the Vietnam War, and this is the kind of thing that leaders are always faced with.
Let me try to again make clear: the most important issue leaders must face, and I think the one we failed on, and I hope that leaders in the future won't, is they should not take this nation to war without the support of the people and the authority of the Congress. That's the point. Now, coming to the, I think it's a subordinate point, assuming for the minute we're involved in war, how can one inform the American people without at the same time, I'll call it giving aid and comfort to the enemy? And that's a very, very difficult point. But let me point out to you what isn't recognized today, that the Vietnam War was the first and only war in which the press was uncensored. The American people were getting press reports from Vietnam every day, uncensored press reports. Now, at the same time, I come back to the point you made earlier, that representatives of the government were finding it difficult at times to be candid with the American people without giving aid and comfort to the enemy. And I don't have any good answer to that. One has to take the circumstances of the time and deal with them.
Well, a couple of things, though, about press censorship. One is it was an undeclared war. I think also some reporters felt that their editors were under pressure by the government.
That is totally wrong. You go back and read the press reports at the time. They were uncensored, and I'll call it unvarnished. And many, many were very critical. Although, let me make this point now, because it's a very important one. It's not recognized today that the Congress was supportive, the press was supportive, the public was supportive of American action in Vietnam. But let me finish this. But that does not relieve the leaders of the government a responsibility to lead. The leaders of our government should not be following the polls. They should not be following the press. They should be leading the nation in the direction in which the nation's interests lie. We thought we were. We weren't.
Robert McNamara is my guest. He's written a memoir called In Retrospect. You say the American public was supportive of the war. I mean, come on. Washington was just filled with demonstrations. Every college campus you went to, there were demonstrations. So maybe the polls indicated to you that there were times when a majority of Americans supported the war, but you knew very well that there was such strong dissent. And in fact, I'd like to ask you
Wait a minute. Let me comment on your question, on your statement, I should say. You're absolutely right. There were massive protests, and I've got an amusing incident if you're interested. One of the protesters, a very close friend of one of my children, and we had them for dinner. I stayed in contact with the protesters. I knew what the protesters were thinking. The majority of the people believed, as we did, and we were mistaken in our judgment, and we should have led the majority of the people to a different view. We believed this nation was under serious threat of communist aggression in Asia and Western Europe, and if we lost Vietnam, in the words of Dean Rusk, we would be facing a catastrophic world war. This was the Eisenhower point in 1954 on the dominoes. That's what we believed at the time. That's what the majority of people believed. The protesters didn't. They were a very vocal minority.
Let me ask you about the anti-war movement. I think some of the conclusions that you reach in your memoir about the war, why the war was unwinnable and why it was a mistake, leaders of the peace movement were saying for many years, for example, that the communist threat wasn't as great as it was represented to be, that the North Vietnamese, even though they had a small and low-tech army, had strong nationalistic feelings and a will to keep fighting, and then that would inspire them to just keep pushing. I'm wondering if you listened to the peace movement at all, or if you shut it out and just thought, you know, they're wrong and I'm not going to pay any attention to what they're saying.
Now, I listened to the peace movement. One of the close friends of my middle child, a daughter, organized and led thousands of individuals to march on Washington, demonstrate against the president, against me. My daughter, on several occasions, brought him home to dinner after that. On one occasion, after dinner, we went into the library. We talked until 10:30. As he left, his last words, very serious, were, "No man can be all bad who loves the mountains as much as you do." I listened to the protesters. I had them in my home. So that's one point. Now, the second point, you have to understand where we came from. And many of the protesters had not. President Kennedy, Dean Rusk, and I, and many others of us, had fought in World War II. 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. Churchill said millions of men lost their lives in that war because the West reacted too late to Hitler's menace to the security of Western Europe. And by God, says Churchill, we should never do that again. Just after that war, the Soviet Union took control of Hungary, Poland, Czechoslovakia. After that, in my period, in August of 1961, the Soviet Union sought to take Berlin. General, I called Norstad, the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, to my office. I asked him how we would have to he said, you may well have to use nuclear weapons. This was a dangerous world. A year later, Khrushchev put nuclear missiles into Cuba. To this day, the American public doesn't know how close we came to nuclear war. In June of 67, the Egyptians vowed to eliminate Israel from the face of the earth. The Israelis learned of it in advance. They attacked Egypt, knocked the hell out of them, hit Jordan as well. Kosygin used the hotline for the first time, the Soviet prime minister, to Johnson, said, if you want war, you'll get it. It was a dangerous world. That was driving us to our action in Vietnam. We were wrong. The protesters turned out, with hindsight, to be right. We didn't believe it at the time.
You wrote in your memoir that one of the things that you found disturbing was that the colleges with the most prestige, the colleges with the highest educational standards, these were the colleges with the most forceful anti-war protests.
It was worse than that. Let me add on that. You haven't quoted the sentence completely. I said it wasn't only the colleges. The best colleges, I'll say, were the hotbeds of protest. It was within those colleges that, I'll call it the higher the level of education, say the graduate students versus the undergraduate, and the higher the level of intellectual achievement, those graduating with distinction and honors as compared to those graduating with normal degrees, that the degree of education, the degree of, I'll call it academic achievement, the higher it was, the greater the protest. And I drew a lesson from that. I thought, my God, these bright, educated people are opposed to our policy. We need to rethink it. And we did, but we always came up against this fear that Eisenhower in his 1954 statement might well have been correct. And Dean Rusk in the statement he wrote to the president, which, by the way, is the only piece of paper that Dean Rusk sent to the president in my 7 years that I didn't see at that time. I didn't see that piece of paper until I got it declassified and started to write this book. Dean said, if we lose Vietnam, we will face a catastrophic war, World War III. Now, we were wrong. I want you to understand that. But when we had faced potential nuclear war with the Soviet Union twice in my years in the Pentagon, one had to think about it. It was a real threat. We overestimated it. We exaggerated it. And a point you made earlier, and I think it's a very important one, and it just slipped by and I didn't comment on it, but let me reemphasize it. You were right. You said that some of the protesters said, and they were right, that this was, in a sense, not a war of communist aggression. It was a civil war. Now, there was some degree of communist aggression, no question about it. But you were right, and they were right. And I think it was, I'll call it, more a civil war than it was a war of communist aggression. I make that point in the book. And let me just finish this sentence once more. We looked upon Ho Chi Minh as a follower of Stalin and Khrushchev, when what he really was, I think, with hindsight, he was an Asian Tito. He was pushing the independence of his people. Now, maybe he would have served the communist cause. He was certainly a communist. Maybe he would have served the communist cause. But the Chinese at that time were calling the U.S. paper tigers. They were saying what was happening in Vietnam was a war of liberation. They were going to extend that across the developing world. I think their words were not supported by actions. Ho Chi Minh, I believe, was a nationalist leading, in his mind, a civil war.
My guest is Robert McNamara, former Secretary of Defense. He's written a new memoir called In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mm-hmm. My guest is Robert McNamara. He was one of the architects of the war in Vietnam. You raise the question in your book, you know, why didn't you and other government officials spend more time on questions that seriously challenged some of the rationales of the war? And you write, readers must wonder, readers of your memoir, must wonder how presumably intelligent, experienced officials failed to address questions whose answers so deeply affected the lives of our citizens and the welfare of our nation. An orderly, rational approach was precluded by the crowding out, which resulted from the fact that Vietnam was but one of a multitude of problems we confronted.
Let me digress just a second to say I signed a contract to write an autobiography. And when I presented the book proposal to publishers, I outlined how I was going to do it, and I had a section on the Defense Department. I was there 7 years. Vietnam was just one of 100 problems, if you will, we were dealing with at that time. I mentioned, I didn't mention one, the Bay of Pigs, which occurred within 90 days after. It was a total debacle. Then we faced Berlin, then we faced Cuba, both of which we handled, I think, very, very wisely and very well. Then we faced the June 67 war. Again, I think we handled very well. But in between this, the cities were burning. We had racial problems. We had riots in the cities. And Vietnam fitted in all of this, and we did not organize properly to deal with it. I think we organized admirably to deal with the nuclear danger in the Cuban Missile Crisis. But it was a relatively simple thing to deal with it. A short period of time, a simple, narrow issue. We should have organized, I'll call it a war cabinet, Churchillian war cabinet, to deal with Vietnam. We didn't. That's one of the reasons we failed to address the questions you've outlined.
But Vietnam was a place where, you know, thousands and thousands of young Americans were dying. I guess it's a kind of frightening thought that you felt you were all just too busy, and that's one of the reasons why the war went the way that it did.
No, no, you're conveying a misimpression. It was that, my God, we were working, 18 hours a day, 7 days a week.
But you were too busy to see more clearly is the point we're trying to make.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that we were overwhelmed with problems and we hadn't organized to segregate out from those people to work solely on Vietnam at the upper echelons of the government. And that's one of the lessons. And in the last chapter, I point to 11 lessons, of which that's one. For God's sakes, Mr. America, when you face military conflict, organize to deal with it effectively.
I want to get back to the peace movement for a second and ask you if this kind of behavior had any effect on you. You write in your memoir about how after speaking to students at the Harvard Business School, a group of students surrounded your car and were shaking it. And I mean, you were surrounded and felt quite under attack. You were at the Seattle airport after climbing Mount Rainier, and a man came up to you and spit on you and called you a murderer. You're at a restaurant, a woman comes up to you and calls you a baby killer. What impact did that have on you?
Well, I relate all that in the book to emphasize that there were protests, and I was aware of them, as I've just outlined. My children were of the generation that was protesting. One of them was at Stanford, for example, and was involved in the protests there. And you point to the protests at Harvard.
Let me focus my question a little bit more so you understand more of what I'm getting at.
No, I understand.
But allow me to just focus it a little more. I'm wondering if that kind of direct confrontation put you in a position of hardening yourself more against the protesters.
Oh, no.
Or whether that behavior reached you and made you think something wrong is happening here.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was the latter. No, it didn't harden me. Harden me? How could it harden me when I mentioned that my daughter brought protesters into the home, and when my son was associated with them in California? And as a matter of fact, I was meeting with one of the major protesters, a chaplain at Yale at the time, and I met with many others because I felt we had to stay in touch with them. And you haven't begun to deal with this issue of protest. Let me tell you something. It's in the book, and I hope your listeners will read it. A man, a Quaker, one of the finest human beings, his name was Morrison. He burned himself to death under my window in the Defense Department. And yesterday, now, so the first point I want to make is I was aware of the way people felt. I was aware of the problem. They didn't see the danger of Soviet communist aggression leading to the world war that Dean Rusk predicted would happen if we didn't save Vietnam. But yesterday, I received from the widow of Mr. Morrison. She's now remarried. Her name is Ann Morrison Welch. A letter, and I want to read one paragraph. To heal the wounds of that war, we must forgive ourselves and each other and help the people of Vietnam to rebuild their country. I am grateful to Robert McNamara for his courageous and honest reappraisal of the Vietnam War and his involvement in it. I hope his book will contribute to the healing process. She was a protester. He was a protester. She is a noble lady. She understands we should look back in retrospect. We should draw the lessons to try to prevent that from happening again.
I guess what I think a lot of people want to know is this. During the period when you had grave doubts about the war and 1,000 Americans a month were getting killed in that war, was it hard for you to not speak out publicly? And then also after you left the administration and the war continued for 7 more years and American casualties continued to mount up, if you had such grave doubts, how did you not manage to share them?
You misstate my position. It wasn't that I had, I'll call it, grave doubts about the war. I had grave doubts that we could win it militarily. And that is a major distinction. At the same time I had grave doubts about winning it militarily, I, along with my associates, believed that if we didn't prevent communist domination of Vietnam and use of that to obtain communist control of Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Laos, Cambodia, we would be moving to a World War III. And therefore, what I had to do was reconcile this fear that we couldn't win militarily with the fear that if we just disengaged, we'd be on the way to World War III. And the way I brought those together in these memoranda of May 67 and November 67 was to say to the president, Mr. President, I don't think we can win militarily. We've got to use our military pressure as a basis for negotiation that will permit us to disengage militarily without leaving South Vietnam to communist control and the start of World War III. That was the basis.
Let me tell you something a friend said to me when she knew I was going to interview you. She said, "Oh, I bet he wrote this book because he knows he's going to meet his maker."
Look, when I meet my maker, the book isn't, he's not going to consider the book. The book was not written for redemption. Redemption is between me and my maker, and the book will have no influence on how he responds to that.
Robert McNamara, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you indeed.
Robert McNamara's new memoir is called In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Actor Peter Gallagher made his breakthrough in Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Now he's starring in Soderbergh's new film, The Underneath. He also co-stars in the romantic comedy, While You Were Sleeping. Coming up, we talk with Peter Gallagher about his stage and screen career. The 1994-95 TV season ended last week. TV critic David Bianculli has the tabulations on the top 10 shows and some thoughts on new trends in programming that may be good news for next season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Federal investigators have charged Michigan brothers Terry and James Nichols with conspiring with Oklahoma bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh to make explosive devices in Michigan. They've also been charged with firearms violations. The charges are not directly related to last week's bombing. James Nichols, a farmer, and his brother Terry have been held as material witnesses to the car bomb attack last week. McVeigh has not been charged in the Michigan complaint. Meanwhile, the FBI has released a more detailed sketch of a second suspect wanted in connection with the blast. He's only been identified as John Doe No. 2. In the wake of the bombing, House Speaker Newt Gingrich wants to limit the number of appeals that convicted murderers can file from death row. Gingrich has also promised early hearings on President Clinton's plan to beef up the FBI. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
If the Oklahoma City bombers are tried, convicted, and sentenced to death, House Speaker Newt Gingrich wants justice to be swift. The speaker told CBS News that's why he's pushing for new limits on death row appeals.
I'm not prejudging anybody, but if people are indicted and convicted after a fair trial, they should be executed within a reasonable time and not be able to sit there for 15 or 20 years filing phony appeals.
The House of Representatives returns next week from spring recess. Gingrich says there could be Tuesday hearings on the president's proposal to make it easier for the FBI to monitor domestic paramilitary groups. Senate hearings are scheduled for this Thursday. I'm John Nielsen in Washington.
The host of a right-wing shortwave radio program says he doesn't condone the Oklahoma City bombing. Mark Kornke also denies knowing Timothy McVeigh, the only person to be charged in the bombing so far. But the leader of a paramilitary group in Florida says McVeigh and Kornke visited southern Florida together about 18 months ago. Ginger Rogers, who lit up the screen with dance partner Fred Astaire, has died at the age of 83. NPR's Melissa Block reports.
Ginger Rogers was a star on Broadway and had made some 20 movies before she ever paired up with Fred Astaire, but she's still best known for their nimble and graceful partnership in 10 musicals, among them Flying Down to Rio, Top Hat, and Shall We Dance. That screen partnership lasted only 6 years, and Ginger Rogers' movie career went on for another 25 years. She starred in a wide range of comedies, romances, and dramas, including Kitty Foyle, which won her the Academy Award for Best Actress in 1940. During the 40s, she was one of Hollywood's highest-paid stars. Rogers was born in Independence, Missouri. She got her start in vaudeville in Texas and first appeared on Broadway in 1929. Her career extended into her late 70s when she performed in her own musical show. Ginger Rogers died at her home in Rancho Mirage, California, apparently of natural causes. I'm Melissa Block in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 4 points to 4,300. This is NPR. Researchers think a new blood test could help detect prostate cancer. A scientist with the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis says a new study shows the test could make it easier to find patients who likely have the cancer and then need follow-up biopsies. A blood screening test now in use detects all types of a protein produced by the prostate. Elevated levels are a possible indicator of cancer, but the test often incorrectly indicates cancer, leading to unnecessary biopsies. Researchers say the new test could cut unneeded biopsies by up to 3/4 and still detect 90% of prostate cancers. Chinese officials say 51 people died this morning in a fire at a karaoke club. The blaze is the latest in a series that have ravaged dance halls and other public places. The BBC's Carrie Nichols, or rather Carrie Grace, reports.
It's still not clear what started the fire in the Urumqi Entertainment Center or what the victims were doing there early on a Monday morning. But what is known is that 51 people died in a building which should not have been open for business at all. In 1994, there were 40,000 fire disasters in China, the worst total in the country's history. Fire chiefs ordered tighter inspections nationwide. As a result, the Urumqi Entertainment Center was ordered to close. Its blocked exits, narrow passageways, and cluttered stairways were unacceptably dangerous, the inspector said. But the owner ignored the order and continued operations until yesterday's blaze. Such contempt for the authority of fire prevention officers and courts is widespread in China.
Carrie Gracie reporting. Lady Bird Johnson, former First Lady and wife of President Lyndon Baines Johnson, has been released from a hospital in Austin, Texas. An official at Seton Medical Center says Mrs. Johnson spent the night there after fainting last night at the end of a dinner party. The 82-year-old former First Lady is now resting at home. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Peter Gallagher's character is in a coma for much of the new romantic comedy While You Were Sleeping. His activity is more vigorous in the film The Underneath, which opens Friday. The Underneath was directed by Steven Soderbergh, whose first film, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, gave Gallagher his breakthrough role. Gallagher also co-starred in Robert Altman's films The Player and Shortcuts. Gallagher recently starred in the Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. In the film The Underneath, Gallagher plays a gambler deep in debt. He returns to his hometown in desperate need of cash, and he gets involved with his ex-wife, who he betrayed in the past and may now be willing to betray him. Peter Gallagher told me he's not a gambler himself. I asked what he did to prepare for the role of a gambler.
For me, that was my most challenging scene when I bet $30,000 on an LSU game. And then they put a second back in the clock, and I lose it all big time. I just tried to figure out what it was going on in the scene, and it was, really about loss. And there's all sorts of ways one can personalize or imagine loss or the admission of great defeat.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape was a real breakthrough for you in terms of recognition.
Yeah.
Were you surprised that the film caught on and became that popular?
Oh, I'm always surprised when anything catches on, because it just was not consistent with my experience.
Right. You're always braced for failure?
Well, not braced, but you just learn after enough of them not to associate the quality of the experience with the commercial outcome.
Have you been in a lot of films that have been hyped as, this is going to make you a star, this is going to be a really popular film, your life will change when this opens in theaters?
Yeah, I'm not a lot of them. I mean, the first movie I ever did, The Idolmaker, there was all that talk. You know, I say, yeah, I'll believe when I see the lines around the block in Times Square. But then it just has this insidious kind of, persuasion. And then you go to a big event at Radio City where there's 6,000 kids and they go nuts, and you think, this might not be too bad, looking at a pretty nice career here. And then the reality is that, the studio's on the verge of going under, and it's maybe not promoted. For whatever reason, it doesn't do well, and then there's an actor strike for 6 months the week after it opens, and there's no production anyway, so the next thing you do is... Next thing I did was Benvolio and Romeo and Juliet at the Long Wharf Theater. So what I learned early on was that life, that one's career, is, as well as life, which I'd been aware of, is full of ironies and full of, occurrences that don't appear at first glimpse logical.
I'm a big fan of The Idolmaker, your first film, the late Ray Sharkey.
Right.
Played a rock producer who... make semi-talented and untalented singers into teen idols, and you played one of the more untalented singers, a singer who was probably based on Fabian. Did you do your own singing for that?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember the songs?
Sure.
What were they?
Baby, However Dark the Night, and those are really, and then there were a couple ones where I was learning how to sing, baby.
Can I force you to do a couple more bars of Baby?
Well, I'll have to back off from the mic. Let's see. Baby, how does it go? I just want to take you where I'm going. Oh, baby. Something like that. Baby, I just want to take you to the sky. Tell me why. Why are we not close together? Oh, boy, I haven't thought about that in about a million years.
Peter Gallagher is my guest, and he stars in two new movies, The Underneath and While You Were Sleeping.
You know, you were Skye Masterson in the recent Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. You were the first Skye in the revival. Mm-hmm. That is just one of the most wonderful musicals. And in part because I think the estate wouldn't let professional productions be done for many years. Every high school and summer camp in America did Guys and Dolls. Did you play Skye in any high school or summer camp productions?
No, never did the show, never saw the show. Oh, I did see the show. I saw with Robert Guillaume and Ken Page in, I guess it was the late 70s, early 80s on Broadway, which I thought was great. No, I never did it. You know, but it was always one of those shows. It was like Long Day's Journey. It was like, you know, one of these days it'll cross your path and you're going to have to do it.
Well, I thought I'd play something, give an example of your singing for Guys and Dolls. Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm going to be selfish here and play one of my favorite songs, especially perhaps my favorite Skye Masterson song, though it's not one of the more famous songs from the show. It's My Time of Day.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I imagine this is the trickiest song for you to sing.
Yeah, that's a hard song.
It's kind of unusual notes in sequence here.
Yeah, the intervals are really tough, mm-hmm. but the poetry is like so evocative. I just think it's a great song. It really evokes New York. It's really about, you know, nighttime in New York, just before dawn, those wee hours. I like it.
My time of day is the dark time. A couple of deals before dawn, when the street belongs to the cop and the janitor with the mop, and the grocery clerks are all gone. When the smell of the rain-washed pavement comes up clean and fresh and cold, and the street lamp light fills a gutter with gold, that's my time of day. My time of day. And you're the only doll I've ever wanted to share it with me.
So, Peter Gallagher, since this is a difficult song to sing, did you ever get lost in a live performance?
Oh, yeah. But not on that song. Yes. I mean, it's first of all, it's every actor's or singer's anxiety. And you can be sure that moments before you step on stage, if you try to remember what it is you're about to say or sing, you will never remember it. And if you haven't done it before, and you take that as a sign that you won't ever remember it, even when the music's playing, you just have a heart-stopping terror. But so you just have to take a breath and think, oh, it'll be there, it'll be there. But all sorts of things come into play, you know. It could be your health that day, your voice. You might be conscious of your voice. Somebody could be out there. Whatever it is, you never know what's going to happen. But I've just butchered wonderful songs with my own improvised lyrics, you know, and trying desperately not to, and looking, staring into the terror of your singing partner's eyes as she sings, oh my God, he's off, he's gone. I hope he comes back to this planet.
Now, are there prompters in the wings to help you out in a situation like that?
No, not really. I mean, if you're really in trouble, somebody, I guess, would shout it out. But the trick is to keep, you know, to allow the story and
music
to continue.
I think someone in the audience would shout it out if it was Guys and Dolls.
Right. Well, I mean, actually, that's kind of funny. That can be distracting, too, because sometimes in the matinees, you know, you're singing, I've never been, and all of a sudden, you know, you're hearing this, I've never been in love before, you know, and it's, and you're saying, what the hell is that coming from? And you realize it's a guy in the second row singing to his deaf wife, you know, or nearly deaf, you know, that's great, they're there, it's lovely, but it's kind of funny.
And you can't say anything.
No, I mean, you can, but by then you just have to sort of see it as an ensemble piece rather than a solo or a duet.
My guest is Peter Gallagher. He stars in the thriller The Underneath, which opens next Friday, and he co-stars in the new romantic comedy While You Were Sleeping. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Peter Gallagher is my guest, and he has two new films, The Underneath, which is directed by Steven Soderbergh, who also directed Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and a romantic comedy called While You Were Sleeping. You're actually in a coma for much of While You Were Sleeping. I mean, not you, the actor, but the character. Character is in a coma. It's probably not a very convincing way to sell a role to an actor to say, here's this part, and your character's in a coma for a lot of the movie.
Well, what was intriguing to me about the film was the fact that it was, I thought it was a charming story and it would be a chance to be in a comedy. But the coma thing was just an added bonus. And it was fortunately not a huge part of the schedule. It was just a couple of days or so shooting. And I tried to fall asleep every time we did it. And I'd make sure I got a good night's sleep the night before. God knows why, but I would, just out of habit, I think.
Practice.
Yeah, I'd think, you know, you could do anything. You could stay out till 6 in the morning and it wouldn't make a bit of difference. But it was fun. I enjoyed the company and I enjoyed the story.
A question I'm always interested in with actors is how they think their looks have affected their career. So let me ask you, how you think your face, your build, has affected the roles people think of you for?
The only thing, I mean, for me personally, it's how I'm generally perceived is inconsistent with how I feel or the image I grew up with of myself, you know. So I'm always a little surprised to hear, you know, the good-looking stuff and all that stuff. But it's fine. It's what it is.
What's the image you grew up with of yourself?
Well, I mean, I was, you know, glasses, and my face was smaller, and my eyebrows and lips were the same size as they are now. So, I mean, it was not a pretty picture.
People make fun of your eyebrows when you were young?
Oh, yeah, and my lips. And, yeah, I'd get into fights about those things. Hey, fat lips. You know, all that just enlightened, kind kid thing.
Did anyone ever ask you to tweeze your eyebrows for a role?
No, actually. My sister first tweezed my eyebrows when I was going to a prom. She literally physically held me down and said, you cannot leave the house and take a girl looking like this. You look like a Neanderthal. Joan, ow. And that was the beginning of it. But during The Idolmaker, actually, Marv Westmore painted eyebrows in for me as the beginning of the young look, which I thought was, I mean, the sort of the ungroomed look. And then they proceeded. Actually, most of my body hair has been removed at one point or another for films. For the first two films, I lost all the hair on my chest and my legs. You tell me, I don't know why. To this day, I don't know why.
So you had to go to, what do you call it, depilation?
No, this was like a chamber of horrors. There was, honestly, it was in Beverly Hills, and this director of The Idolmaker said, the only way it can be done is if it's waxed, that your chest hair is waxed. I said, why? He said, well, believe me, it's best. So being one to surrender, you know, at that point I was willing to surrender my good judgment to anyone who had a credit to their name. And I went to this place, and she waxed my chest, put this linen on right down the center of my chest, and she said, honest, I swear she said this in some kind of vague dialect, now you know what women must go through all the time. And she just, and I almost, it was like a million volts to my chest. I sat out in my car and wept. I felt like I had been completely emasculated because I was still pretty young. I mean, my chest hair had just come in pretty much. And I was like, who am I? So that was, why are we talking about my chest territory?
Oh, we got from your eyebrows to your chest hair.
Oh, okay, that's a leap.
So when they painted your eyebrows for The Idolmaker,
mm-hmm.
Well, I don't understand why they had to paint them. You already had them.
Well, it was a matching thing. In the morning I had to have them, in the afternoon I wouldn't have to have them, and then the next morning I might have to have them again. I mean, I can...
Oh, so they shaved
them
off altogether so that they could put them on and take them off.
Yeah, well, they took them off the middle part, just the middle part.
Mm-hmm. You know. I think acting must be a really complicated thing for the human ego. On the one hand, you're always getting rejected, particularly early in your career, right, for the roles you didn't get and the movies that were flops or whatever. On the other hand, when something is good, you get extraordinary success and recognition. So it really puts the ego through a lot of expansion and shrinkage and insecurity and narcissism, mix of everything. Has that been hard on you? Have you had a frame of mind that could withstand easily all the ego ups and downs of the acting business?
Yeah. I think now I'm in a healthier position because I have a family and I have children, and I'm not, you know, no longer, I'm past 29, which I think is a tumultuous, it's akin to a midlife crisis for, which is what I'm looking forward to next, I'm sure. But, you know, the bottom line is I really love acting and still do. And I realize that finding a way, I've always admired the people who survive well in this business. I count Robert Altman as one of them, and Lemon, and, you know, and tons of the people I've met.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and those that survive with their humanity intact somewhat, and still a great love of storytelling and of actors, and a sense of humor, are people that I really genuinely admire.
Peter Gallagher, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Gallagher stars in the film The Underneath, which opens on Friday, and he co-stars in the new romantic comedy While You Were Sleeping. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have from Oklahoma City?
Hi, Terry. We'll have the latest developments on the investigation into the bombing there of the federal building and a discussion of whether a defendant in such a case could get a fair trial in Oklahoma City or, in fact, anywhere in America. Howard Berkus reports on two events in the past that could have resonance with the Oklahoma story, the Waco shootout with federal agents 2 years ago and a gun battle in Idaho with Randy Weaver back in 1992. Also, Maria Inahosa reports on what the FBI can and cannot do right now to infiltrate suspect groups. And Andre Kudrescu, his thoughts on the past week's events in Oklahoma and beyond.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The 30-week 1994-95 TV season, which began in mid-September, came to a close last week. TV critic David Bianculli has some final observations, and they're surprisingly encouraging.
When all the ratings were in for the season, ABC was the easy winner, NBC came in second, and CBS finished third. 10 years ago, I would have said that CBS finished last. But now that there are new networks from Warner Brothers and Paramount, as well as the increasingly strong Fox, CBS finishes in the standings as third out of a field of six. And they said expansion was weakening baseball. Even so, as TV seasons go, it was a very good year. Maybe the best thing that happened was that the networks finally got tired of making those rip-from-the-headlines telemovies and celebrity docudramas. The networks stopped only because people got tired of watching them, but it's a victory nonetheless. We'll still see some, but not as many as last season when there were two Roseanne bios in as many weeks. Also, most news magazines began to drop in the ratings, which is good because it opens up late evening time slots for more adult dramas. This trend was driven by a brand new NBC show that ended the season ranked in second place, the highest finish ever for a first-year drama series.
Dr. Green? Dr. Green?
What is it?
Patient for you, Dr. Green.
Can't the intern take it?
It's for you.
What time is it?
5:00.
All right. Oh, can't the intern take it?
It's Dr. Ross.
Dr. Ross? I'll be right there.
ER wasn't the only new series to finish the year in the top 10. Another NBC series, Friends, ended up in 8th place, which is pretty impressive. Then again, the entire top 10 is impressive. The most popular TV series last season, according to the Nielsen ratings, was Seinfeld, the first time it ever ranked that high. Then came ER, followed by... No, wait a second. Before I read this list, I want to make a fast point. When you listen to TV's top 10 for the season, think about how many shows you do watch or could watch without feeling like you've wasted your time or been thoroughly insulted. Then check out the most recent New York Times bestseller list, or box office movie grosses, and see how high the percentage of quality stacks up there. So here's the TV top 10. Seinfeld, ER, Home Improvement, Grace Under Fire, Monday Night Football, 60 Minutes, NYPD Blue, Friends, and, in a tie for 9th place, Roseanne and Murder, She Wrote. There are two other trends worth noting. One is that there's a continuing appetite for TV blasts from the past. The two most popular telemovies last season were new versions of The Rockford Files and Cagney and Lacey. The other trend is that TV keeps generating and cultivating some really good shows, and viewers are starting to support them. One second-year drama, even though it ended the season in 71st place, saw its audience almost double since last season and showed more growth than any other primetime series. Which show was it? Here's a musical clue. And The X-Files wasn't the only terrific series on TV last season. Outside of the top 10, other returning favorites included The Simpsons, Picket Fences, Frasier, Homicide: Life on the Street, and Mad About You. There were new shows, too, that I never missed, like Chicago Hope, My So-Called Life, and VR5. To me, with all those quality options, it's not only a good TV season, it's a great one.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Roberta Shurrock, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Updike and Barbara Bogave, research assistants from Becky Cohen. Our interns are Zeb Esselstyn and Sienna Chrisman. I'm Terry Gross. We close with the music of Ginger Rogers, who has died at her home in California at the age of 83. She began her collaboration with Fred Astaire in the 1933 film Flying Down to Rio. They appeared in 10 films together and defined a style of dance and an era in movie musicals. Here's Ginger Rogers singing Let Yourself Go with the Jimmy Dorsey Orchestra, recorded in 1936.
So come, get together, let the dance floor feel your leather. Step as lightly as a feather, let yourself go. Come, hit the timber, loosen up and start to limber. Can't you hear that hot marimba? Let yourself go. Let yourself go, relax and let yourself go. Relax, you got yourself tied up in a knot. The night is cold, but the music's hot, so come. Cuddle closer, don't you dare to answer no, sir. Butcher, banker, clerk, and grocer, let yourself go.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from Random House, publisher of Dr. Seuss and Mr. Geisel, a biography by Judith and Neil Morgan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
5-year-old Marcus Yates was killed in the crossfire of a drug shootout in a Philadelphia variety store. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk to his parents, Anthony and Rochelle Yates, who have since become activists against drugs and violence. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.